Welcome to the Mind Chimp Podcast.
Melis, welcome to the Mind Chimp Podcast. How are we doing?
We're doing really well, Denny. Thanks for having me.
No, thank you for coming on. I'm super happy to have you on. Your book is fundamentally one of the books which helped me identify who I was as a person and as a designer, and yeah, just allow me to see the world in through just ultimately asking myself some questions and probing who I was first and foremost. In my book, I name check you at least 4 or 5 times. I'm sure I do. So apologies, or there you go. But I guess before we get into who you are, Melis, I tend to ask my guest to summarize himself in one sentence. What would your sentence be?
Insatiably interested in the human condition.
Okay. Nice. We will touch on that, I'm sure, throughout.
Yes.
So I guess for my listeners who may not have come across you, Melis, maybe give us a bit of a whistle-stop tour of your kind of career and where you've come from and where you are right now.
Sure. I'm also conscious I have a dog that's snoring behind me. I'm just hoping that's not coming through. There's not much I can do about moving him, unfortunately.
Guest appearance. It's fine.
Okay, good. We'll just keep going. Right, whistle-stop tour of my career. So I guess I'm a bit of a hybrid person in terms of my qualifications and interests. So I started off interested – the through line of my career has always been people, like humans, from a perspective of how do they organize their experience around living. So it was always a really big question. And I started with – quite literally the brain, like imaging the brain. So I did an undergrad in biomedical engineering and I majored in neuroscience, and then I was very much in the science world. And then you're probably going to ask me questions about this later on, but there was quite a significant event that happened when I was in Japan. I had this realization of what I was actually interested in, which is not necessarily how the brain worked, but how do we design for the brain? How do we design for people? And so that led me into the field of human factors, and I did my PhD in human-centered design, particularly interested in situational awareness and workload and designing for improved performance. And I did that at the point of the pointy end, you know, when humans are trained to the hilt and they're in technology that's pushed to the hilt, and that was in the Defence Department in Australia. And then from there, I have always held roles that were responsible for holding and advocating for the human experience in any system that was being designed. So that was, you know, at Ford and Sumitomo in automotive manufacturing. It was at Telstra with emerging technology. And then eventually I started Huddle in 2009 with my co-founder and partner. And we ran that for about 12, 13 years. And that was a consulting firm. And in amongst that, I wrote a couple of books. And now my whole focus is on supporting people to develop the inner scaffolding that has them be able to meet the world in the way that the world needs to be met, especially if you have the skills of design and systemic designing. And I'm doing that under this human.
Nice. There's a lot there, but I love that analogy, that kind of inner scaffolding. It just gave me a nice visual picture. But I think when I think about the book, so you've got This Human, you've got design character.
Yeah.
This Human for me was important for a few different things to design, because I've been on the design character course and stuff.
Yes.
And it, you know, yeah, it was awesome when we talk about values and behaviors, and we'll get into all that in a bit.
Yeah.
But when you designed, when you wrote This Human, what was, we talked about it when I was doing my book around having that kind of vision and having that who you're writing for. Who was the person who you was writing for when you wrote that?
Well, I was I actually had a few people from Huddle. I had their pictures sort of hanging on my wall behind my monitor, quite literally. So I would look at them, and then I would be thinking about, you know, how I would be speaking with them about the thing that I wanted to write about. So there were some very specific people, but generally, I was writing for designers who were really talented individuals and knew exactly all of the processes, all of the frameworks, all of the tools, had been practicing design for a while, and were increasingly finding it more and more stressful, more and more challenging to continue to hold the tension that we often have to hold as innovators and creatives and designers within, you know, organizations that aren't necessarily inherently that way. And what I realized was it didn't matter how good you were at the tools or how good you were at doing, you know, your practice as a designer, the thing that had you continue to be able to step up to the mat and show up and do great work was actually who you were as a designer and how you were as a designer. And that's what this human was about. That was the first kind of attempt at being able to create something that was coherent around how to develop yourself from the inside out, specifically within the frame of doing, you know, service and strategic and systemic design within organizations. So it's kind of like this human, the first book is kind of like it's a smorgasbord, and you kind of, you can almost start the book at any point and get a bit of insight, and there's an exercise, and it's very, very practical. It's almost like a guide. And Design Character is a real deep dive. Like it took me 5 or 6 years to pluck up the courage to write that book, because we dive deep into values and ethics and, you know, some of the practices that are just missing in design, like design supervision or reflexivity, and why it's important to cultivate our own perspective of that. And we, you know, cover really heavy topics like moral fading and all of that kind of stuff. So it took me a bit of a run up to be able to get all that material together for the second book. But they're both about that inner scaffolding. They're both about, you know, my hope and the ultimate outcome that I'm in service of with this work is that we have people out there with the skill sets that can design shared realities for other peoples from this place of deep, deep conscious awareness and humility and clarity around who they are as those people and what platform they stand on and what informs the decisions that create these realities, these shared realities for others. And, you know, I often talk about the most dangerous design being that is unconscious. You know, you don't know why you're making the decisions that you're making. So that's the mission, I guess.
Okay. If I was to go back in time and go and speak to maybe one of your favorite teachers, and I was to ask him, what's Melissa going to be when she grows up? What would they have told me?
They would have said Charlie off Top Gun.
Okay. Explain that one to me.
So I went to see Top Gun when I was about 10, I think. You can do the math. That sort of dates me quite accurately, with my dad. Dad's an avionics engineer, and he took me to see Top Gun. We were living in this tiny little town called Grovedale in Geelong in Australia. And I just was so excited at the pace and the, you know, just the fact that, you know, the world's top 1% of, you know, fighter pilots and all this sort of stuff. And then there's this scene after the famous scene where they sing to Charlie's character, Kelly McGillis's character, in the bar, and she gets introduced as their instructor. And she gets introduced as, you know, she has a PhD in astrophysics, and she's a civilian contractor, so you don't need to salute her. but she's going to be assessing your performance. And I remember as a 10-year-old girl, and back then there weren't that many really powerful female role models actually. And I remember looking up at the big screen. She was massive, right? She was on the big screen at the Village Cinemas. And she was standing there in front of all these men, and they were amazing at what they did, and she was going to make them better. And I was like, that's me. Like, that's who I want to be. And I got to sort of experience that to a degree when I did my PhD, you know, working with FA-18, F-111 cockpit systems and doing well. I was a civilian contractor working in the Air Operations Division at the Australian Defence Department. So there's, you know, that dream's sort of well fulfilled. But that's what they would have said. She wants to be Charlie of Top Gun.
I like it. I'm going to ask you to pick a number from 1 to 12 for me, okay? And I'm going to ask you what I call a killer question. And then I don't need the answer straight away, but I will come back to it. So, yeah, pick a number from 1 to 12 for me, please, Melissa.
8.
8. Okay. So a question you've picked is, do you like yourself? Okay. So I'll come back to it a little bit later, so on. Okay. So you go from Charlie, you know, potentially being Charlie from Top Gun, to an author, and then, you know, the other kind of stuff what you're working on right now. So it sounds like a big shift. I guess the thing what kind of threads throughout is that kind of values, right? That behaviors. And there's a few things in This Human what I really liked, and there's so much to go through on This Human that I won't do it justice. So I'm gonna pick a few things out, but there's a big caveat that everyone should go and buy the book, right? Like I think I've recommended it at least 7 times. But I guess for me, let's needle into the first one. So there's a piece in there around 7 channels of listening. I guess, you know, when I think about it in the working world, many people don't go through the full 7 channels, right? Some tend to sit at level 3 or whatever. Tell us a little bit about what that is.
Yeah, so this is work that originated in Professor Harold Nelson's work, who I call my design dad. So he's now, I don't know, in his 80s or something probably, and he's going strong in creating the very conscious and deliberate field of systemic design from his lens, which has always been fascinating to me. He's a very, very interesting character, and people should just go look him up and buy his book called The Design Way. But he talks about listening and how we have different ways of listening that actually create different outcomes depending on where you're listening from. And there's certain conversations that require a certain type of listening to do that conversation justice. And we're often not conscious of how we're listening or why we're listening from that place. And I just found that it was so critical to a designer's work to be able to have this map in their minds, not only about where they are listening from, but where are other people listening from. And it's almost this listening to listening part that becomes really critical in an innovator or a designer's toolkit, because, you know, say you're in a situation where you are sharing a new potential product or a new idea, and you've got a room full of people and they're listening to you from the critical channel, which is all about data and evidence and wanting to know who and when and how much. If you don't have this map, then you're less likely to be able to call that the listening in the room isn't appropriate for the presentation that you're giving. And with all of these maps, it gives you the clarity to be able to do something about it. So in that situation, you might say, I can understand that the listening in the room right now is about data and evidence, and that all of those things are really important. And in about 15 minutes, we're going to get to that, and I'm going to ask you to listen from that place. Right now, we are wanting to generate, we want to build on what it is that I'm about to share, which is an idea. It's new, it's fledgling. And so I'd really love for you to be listening from a different place, to be listening from a generative place, which is really just about how can we make this better, stronger? And then later we will get to that other place where you can listen from, which is the how much, how soon, you know, who. And it just gives designers and innovators an extra map to be able to bring, you know, consciousness to what's actually happening in the room and where we need it to be. And that's why it's in this human book. That's what it's for, is to help, again, this word scaffold, those types of conversations.
I think there's something really nice about how you just explained that, and like just the clear signaling really early, like, I know you're here, but in order to get there, we've got to go here first. That's just a really nice clear signaling to it. The other thing, kind of what I remember from This Human, is critique versus criticism. And this is something I literally have this saved in my notes, because there's times where I'm like, oh, no, this is, I'm being the wrong type of person here. I'm being like X up versus Y. And I'm like, it's just a nice nudge for me, because I can find myself sometimes going between the two. But you have a really nice way of explaining the difference. So yeah, could you maybe explain that for me?
Yeah. So in any sort of creative work, and I use the word design and creativity in its most broad and inclusive sense. So, you know, people who are obviously trained in design or in the creative industries will have to go through some form of design critique. It's a part of the process of design. But I see people from, you know, HR and engineering and infrastructure services and, you know, those people who are constantly problem solving and trying to bring in new ideas and stuff. I see them as designers as well, people who are going from nothing to something or just changing something that exists. I call them designers. So I just wanted to you know, have that clear when I answer this question. People who aren't necessarily trained or indoctrinated into the world of critiques can find the process really challenging, and also aren't trained in how to provide critique. And so it was really important to have that bit in This Human, which is to be able to draw attention to what criticism is, which is very much coming from a place of personal preference. And it's like, I don't like that color. You know, that doesn't, that looks, that form factor, you know, looks a bit ugly to me. The way that you've designed this approach doesn't seem to align with the service design blueprint process that I like. So that's a place of criticism, where it's coming from a personal preference place. And critique is about aligning to the overall outcome of the work. And it's an external, it can never be completely objective, because we are people and there's always subjectivity when we show up. But it's really about, how can I help this designer achieve the outcome that this work is ultimately in service of? And it might not be aligned with your preference. That critique might actually not be aligned with your preference. The client may have asked for a hideous yellow, all yellow something, and yellow is your least favorite color. Or to put it in a service design context, the client may have wanted a really scaled back, simplistic, two-step service model, because that is what their business can withhold, and you have a preference to actually serve customers better. But that's not what a critique is about. A critique is about bringing multiple perspectives in a room in service of the ultimate outcome. And sometimes we need to leave our preferences on the other side of the door. And this can become a real art, I think, because sometimes, say you're a creative director and you've been doing this for years and years, your preference has been honed through experience. So sometimes you do need to kind of bring it in and going, no, we are absolutely not going to use that. We're going to do this other thing. And so it is this real, it is a real balance, but just starting with that awareness, like, is this a personal preference of mine, or am I actually objectively in service of the outcome? That'll just give you some sort of an inner guidance mechanism.
Mm. Nice.
Yeah.
I think there's just a nice little thing when I go to meetings, whether it is, you know, critique, a lot of times what I've started doing now, probably for the last year and a half, is I've just asked people, how do you want me to show up?
Yeah.
Like, how do you want me to show up for this meeting? And I think it sounds so simple, but yeah, it's just a nice way to go, oh, you want me to show up to play your critical friend or to be the kind of person who's going to give you critique or whatever. And I just think there's something around signaling it really early, because it creates that safe space of, okay, you've asked me to show up in this way and that's what I'm going to do. I don't know. It just feels like it was a nice way to create that safety.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And there's also different types of critique. So sometimes I've seen, you know, I really, just to give a bit of a background as to what's informed my experience and understanding of this process, is I basically cut my teeth in design at Ford as a design engineer. So I was the person responsible for the design of the anything that the driver and passenger touched, basically, in the car. So that was the human-centered design part of the role. And there's different stages of a design. You know, there's things at the beginning where it's all a bit loosey-goosey and you don't quite know where things are going to go. And if someone were to come in and do a detailed critique session at that point, at that level of design, then it's just a waste of everyone's time, actually. It's demoralizing for the designer because the design isn't resolved enough to withstand that type of critique. And it's a waste of the person's time who's doing the critiquing, because we can't actually implement any of the things that have been suggested. So that early signaling is really, really critical, actually, to be able to set up. And there's a whole section of that in the book around setting up a blissful critique, where you actually do all of that. You kind of go, well, this is where the design is at. This is the type of feedback that we're looking for. These are the sorts of critique points we're going to be talking about. And this is the level of critique we're seeking from you. And when someone strays outside of those constraints, then there's a frame that can be referred back to say, well, actually, we're not doing that in this session. We're going to do that in 3 weeks' time when the design's ready for that level of critique. So that's also really critical, I think, and speaking to your point of early signaling.
There's For them who haven't seen the book, you did the illustrations for the book as well, right? It's like, and there's a great visual in there, I think, if I remember rightly. Because I think I've known you for maybe, what, 3-4 years, maybe,
yeah.
Give or take?
Yeah, probably.
I think maybe. Yeah, and there's a bit where it's like, there's a bit where it's talking about, I think it's either talking about sitting with your tension or sitting with ambiguity on the sofa. I still remember that to this day. It's just a really cool visual. But I like how you frame tension and I like how you frame ambiguity. And, you know, I think there's a lot of people, a lot of listeners who listen to this are constantly sitting with, well, maybe not sitting with it, but we're in constant change, we're in constant ambiguity. And I guess from a human point of view, what tips would you probably give them to kind of, yeah, deal with that tension?
Yeah. So I think... It's a big topic. So
it's a big
I'm trying to work out how to summarize it. So I think one of the things that we are sort of socialized and trained to do as we go through schooling, wherever you are, is that we are taught that we can think through problems. And that's really true up until a point. And having done, you know, the work I've done in neurosciences and in understanding the brain, we think the brain is all powerful, but it's actually it's quite limited in what it can do. It's a magical, amazing part of us, but also quite limited. And there is an order of complexity that we get to where we actually just can't think through it. It's too complex and too ambiguous for us to even be able to do the thinking. And that's when I say it's at that point that the thing that's going to bring clarity is action. So we have to act through complexity. We have to act through ambiguity. And that's the thing that people find quite paralyzing because of their training around we need to think through the problem before we take action. And sometimes in a highly ambiguous and highly complex system, we can only think through a portion of it and take the next best action. And as soon as you take that action, the system will respond and you'll have more information and you'll be able to take the next action. And it might not be a straight line. It might be a bit kind of like an ant trail, but you'll be gaining more and more and more and more clarity as you act through that system. And I guess that's the thing that I would remind people of, is that sometimes it's going to feel really uncomfortable because you won't have the answers and you can't think through it. But if you take the next best action, I guarantee that you will have new information that you can then start incorporating into your thinking. And that's the thing. And with designers, you know, we're trained to deliberately turn up ambiguity, especially in the early parts of, because we want to see like what opportunities are outside of our field of view right now. So what if we do this? What if we do that? What if we were on the moon? What if we were underwater? What if we thought that this was a cruise ship? Or what if we thought this was a hospital? You know, we deliberately do that to gain more information, to gain more access to ideas and opportunities. So, yeah.
It's I don't think I've ever shared this on the podcast before. Many years ago now, actually, I was in a really dark place, really bad place, to the point where I tried to kill myself. And I remember before I ever got there, it felt like there was this thing where I was constantly had another decision and then another decision and another decision and another, and it was kind of bombarding. It started to compound down. And it's just, you just kind of got me thinking about it there. All that was because I didn't make decisions. I was just waiting and waiting for, give me more information so I can make a more educated guess. And I couldn't. And in the end, I just ended up making too many decisions, having too many to make that decision for. And it got to the point where it broke me. And it's fascinating. When I think about ambiguity right now, I'm great dealing with other people's ambiguity. Dealing with my own is still a good, still an adventure I'm on, for sure.
For sure. For sure. Because it's like there's a lot of safety and certainty. Yeah, I also just want to acknowledge what you just shared, Danny. Thank you for sharing that. It's quite a significant connection that you've made to what I've said to that experience, actually, because it's usually the build up of that is like this feeling of overwhelm that you can't see resolution for, right? And it's just a really tender and important topic that you've touched on that I'm sure there's lots of people sitting with at the moment. So I just want to really acknowledge that.
Thank you.
Before we move on.
Yeah.
There's a lot of safety and certainty, you know. So one of the, you know, primary drivers that we have is to move away from pain and towards pleasure. And safety feels really nice for us. Like from an evolutionary perspective, we strive for safety. And we feel safe when we're certain. We're certain about our environment. We're certain about where our food's going to come from. We're certain about the security of the tribe. And in situations of uncertainty and ambiguity, we don't have that. And so the tendency is to get us back to certainty as quick as possible. And that's one of the things that, you know, kills creativity in an organization, is that drive. Like, I have a lot of empathy for that drive. I have a lot of empathy for people who will walk into a room and see a bunch of crazy ideas that they haven't necessarily contributed to and just go, holy shit, this is terrifying. Turn it off. Shut it down. Mm. You know? So, like, I have a really deep understanding and appreciation of that process. And yet, when we are living in a context where everything is changing at exponential rates, not everything, some things are changing at exponential rates and some things are changing at an evolutionary scale. And the gap between those two things is just like, who knows what's going to happen. So we actually do need to get a little bit more comfortable with sitting on the couch with ambiguity and just kind of going, okay, here we are. We're just going to have to sit in this until our fingers get all pruny.
I guess this links me onto design character then. So, you know, when people struggle with dealing with ambiguity, is that something to do with there's a clash in values or a clash in behaviours? I don't know. But, like, you know, when I was on the course, what you did, the design character, and we talked about Schwartz values.
Yeah.
Values, yeah. And the conflict in them. And is it a case of people don't like it because the value is, so for me, you know, I value just innovation in general and creativity and spontaneous and whatever else. But then there's certain people who've worked in the past who don't. And does the conflict come from the value that I value something more than they do? And is that where the friction is? Again, yeah. Take any piece of that big long sentence.
Yeah. I mean, I think ambiguity and uncertainty can feel different for different people depending on what your values are. I don't necessarily think it comes from a clash in values between people. So someone who values self-direction and stimulation, for example, so we're referring to the Schwartz value circumflex for people who are listening. If you are oriented that way, so self-direction, stimulation, spontaneity, emergence, novelty, they're all things that you're just going to be going nom, 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 like you love it, right? Versus a person who is more oriented towards conformity and tradition, in situations where there's spontaneity and emergence and uncertainty, they're just going to be like, get me back to safe places, get me back to my rituals, get me back to my traditions. That's what I value. That's how I orient myself in this world. And so it's almost like the context might be exactly the same for the two people, but their values orientation is going to have them experience that context in fundamentally different ways. I don't think ambiguity necessarily arises from that.
Mm. So there's definitely a piece around identifying your values. And how long did it take you to identify, you know, if you think about kind of your experiences and everything, you know, if I guess the way I kind of like to see it, again, this could be completely wrong, but if your values are kind of like the instruction, I guess, like it's the output of something, your beliefs. How long did it take you to find your values? And are your values changing as you kind of, as you grow, I guess?
Yeah. So it's sort of, I'm just wondering if I can tell the story. It struck me after something happened when I was actually at Telstra and I was working with a group of amazing, amazing people. So these were all sort of PhD postdocs at the leading edge of sort of emerging tech. Like it was the old Telstra Research Labs, just incredible, incredible minds. And we were sitting, the senior sort of leadership team was sitting around a table and one particular person was asked someone to report out on a project. And as they were reporting out, they basically said, "You're a bozo." And I found myself saying, "You can't say that." Like it was like moving your hand away from a hot pan. Like it was an instinct. I didn't, I, it came out of my mouth and then I went, holy shit, I just said that thing to this really senior person. And they sort of turned around, they looked at me and they said, well, what do you mean I can't say that? And I said, well, it's just, it's utterly inappropriate. This person is an expert in their field. They're sharing their findings. It's just not okay. But I didn't know why it was not okay. Like, I didn't understand what was having me, you know, exclaim the way that I did. And that was the trigger to have me kind of go, well, what just happened there? Like, why was it that I felt like I couldn't not say something? And then that was the trigger for me to explore the deeper processes around, you know, beliefs and values and how they are very, very deep motivators, actually. They motivate action. They direct thought. They're like the things that are actually doing all of the directing. They've got the steering wheel. And so I thought, well, if I want to have as much agency as I want to have in my career and turn up the way that I really want to show up in these forums, then I need to understand what that is. And that's when it started. And that was literally, that was 20 years ago. Yeah, 20 years ago. And that's basically what I've been studying, is what drives us as people.
So I guess I'm going to try and put it in a context. So I think we have individuals, we have our values. But you see a lot, excuse me, you see a lot of companies, they have their company values, okay? And I'm a big believer of not having culture fit. I'm a big believer in two things. I'm a believer in culture ad, not culture fit. And I'm a believer in having a healthy disrespect. Maybe, yeah, it's probably the wrong word, but yeah, healthy disrespect of, and being able to challenge, I guess, ultimately. But it's funny, you know, a lot of companies bring people in, we go, oh, are they a culture fit? Do they measure on our values and stuff like that? But when we've got all these complex humans going into this business and then we're saying, hey, you complex people, now you've got to align with our values. Is that fundamentally flawed, or is it a case of get in line or get out, I guess? It feels like a hard one.
Yeah, well, I think you need, to use one of my favourite words, I think you need a smoosh of that. So, you know, just go back to the times where I was working in the Defence Department. The FA-18 pilots and F-111 pilots fly fundamentally different aircraft. So an FA-18 is a frontline striker aircraft, low altitude. F-111 is a high altitude reconnaissance bomber. Fundamentally different roles. And their training is different. And their recruitment is different as well, because the tasks associated with what you do in an FA-18 versus what you do in an F-111 require a different orientation as a person, different disposition, a different personality type, and perhaps even different values that inform the role that those two aircraft would do and the people within it. And I feel like that is really critical. I'm using a difficult scenario, but that type of match is actually really critical in some situations. So there is a part where I feel we need to be looking for alignment in terms of our values. So let's take another scenario of a social enterprise who is, their whole remit is to talk about something that's close to my heart, get into regenerative agriculture. And that with it, if that mission with it has an inherent value of respecting and having reverence for nature. And it wouldn't make a lot of sense for someone to apply for that with the complete opposite value set, who is valuing power domination and extraction. So I feel like there is a role for alignment for sure. And at the same time, we only get progress retention. So we need to also have those individuals that are kind of like, you know what, I am deeply agitated and dissatisfied at the moment. And here's why. And to be challenging. Like, I really like the bit that you said. I would probably say it's still respectful when you do it, when you do the challenging. I would not necessarily say it's disrespectful.
And this is why nobody replies.
So, but I feel like that challenge piece that you're talking about is critical. Critical. And I love the sort of culture add as opposed to culture fit, because it's also through that diversity and that otherness that you get when you've got people that have come from, you know, different walks of life and different, you know, worldviews and experiences, that creates the richness that we need and the depth that we need. So that's why I think it's a bit of a smoosh. That's the answer.
I mean, smoosh is good for any question, right?
Yeah.
Okay then. So I'm going to ask you a bit of a weighty question. Are humans better at creation or destruction?
I would say we are good in equal measure. Okay. I would say that the most creative people in the world, like, I guess the thing that's sort of, I'm just going back to a talk I gave at South by Southwest, which is the dark side of design. And while I was doing the research for that, I actually found a lot of creativity in destructive behavior. Like, destruction can be really creative. And I feel like it's basically, humans are inherently creative species. That's why we are at the top of the food chain. That's why we are so adaptable. That's why we have succeeded in doing what we have done, if you see it as success. If we see survival as success, we're very good at it. We're the best at it. And I feel like creativity has lots of different manifestations. I think creativity can manifest as destruction. And I think creativity can manifest as regeneration. And I feel like we're good at it. We're really good at it. We're really good at the destruction bit, and we're really good at the regenerative bit. And the thing that sort of, the way that I see it is that as we've evolved and as society has changed, if you were to think about creative destruction on one end and creative regeneration on the other, I feel like, you know, thousands of years ago, that difference between those two things was quite small. And as we have evolved or progressed, and I'm using the little air talky mark things with my fingers, the distance between creative destruction and creative regeneration has increased. And that's the thing that is scary. And the pace has increased as well because of that. So that's how I would attempt at answering your very challenging question.
No, I like that. I like that. And that leads me on to my next one, which is, you know, the kind of regenerative kind of design and your next adventure, I guess. Yeah, tell me. So for someone like me, I'm nowhere near as versed as I should be in regenerative design. But maybe, yeah, tell the listeners about what that even means, I guess, first and foremost, and why it's a big passion for you as well.
Yeah, so I guess it does sort of move on quite nicely from what we just talked about. So I guess, you know, I have a deep respect and reverence for people who choose to be in the field of creative regeneration. So people who are using creativity and design and innovation to try and get us closer to something that's sort of equitable and fair and not harmful. And I find that when we think about the major challenges that we're facing collectively, the one that I'm particularly focused on at the moment is climate. And the reason why that is something that I'm really interested in is because I've always been fascinated by nature and how nature solves problems creatively. And it's not like she has a design workshop and gets multiple people in the room and does an ideation session and, you know, the way that humans go about doing creative work. She has this inherent intelligence that responds to its context and has a persistent and pervasive drive towards life, towards providing life and giving life. And, you know, when you see those massive slabs of concrete and you've got these tiny little green shoots coming up through any particular crack that it can find, like this constant drive for creative life is something that I just am inspired by. And when I think about regenerative systems, when I think about regenerative design, it's getting as close as we possibly can as a human species to mimicking that creative inherent intelligence towards life, towards systems that are going to live on and not die and become destructive. Now, that's separate to the cycle of life. That's a different thing. But so far, we've completely so immersed in this topic at the moment is that we've changed our personal life to fall in step with this. So just this week I will be stepping foot onto my farm, which is in a rural part of Victoria in a place called Nearham Junction. And we're going to start the process of regenerating the soil and using permaculture principles and regenerative agriculture principles. I am going to learn about what regenerative systems actually are, not from a theoretical perspective, but from collaborating deeply with nature and learning from that. And so in 6 months' time, invite me back onto your podcast and I can share with you what I've learned.
100%. I will be doing just that. I want to be really mindful of your time, so I have two questions.
Yeah.
Question number one is, so do you like yourself?
Yeah, that is a really tricky question. The answer is yes, I do. I really like myself. And it took me a very long time and a lot of work and deep, deep meditation practice to get to the place where I 100% believe that.
Okay. Okay. Nice. Good. Good. So the books, getting in contact with you, getting on the courses, the coaching, where can people follow you? Where can they get in touch with you, Liz?
Yeah, so I am a little bit of a digital hermit. I'm difficult to find on the socials. There's like hardly anything going on there. But the best place to go is thishuman.com. And it is like the launch pad to everything that is This Human. You'll find a link to This Human Community, which is hosted on Mighty Networks. Beautiful community of about, I don't know, there's hundreds of people in there now. All over the world, you'll find your tribe there. That's where a lot of the courses are run within that community. There's a design character course which follows the book, which you have experienced.
Yep.
And there's a beautiful course on the stories that we tell ourselves. So this is about the inner narratives that we have and how they basically inform or shape the way that we experience the world and relationships because of the stories that we're telling ourselves internally. And then there's a little mini course on This Human Essentials, which is like a nice little taster into this world of how to be the person designing with other people. So thishuman.com is the place to go.
Perfect. Liz, it's always a pleasure. And from a personal point of view, thank you for being an unofficial mentor to me. You definitely have been awesome. So yeah, I can't express how much, how important it is for me. So thank you.
Absolutely. No problem. Thanks for having me on.
It's an absolute pleasure. I'll catch you later, Liz. Bye-bye.
Bye. Sure.